Good evening. Embassy protectors are evicted and arrested in Washington. Is the U.S. moving towards war with Iran? And the mayor throws his hat in the ring. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for Thursday, May 16th, 2019. On Thursday morning, federal officers summoned military fatigues entered the Venezuelan embassy in Georgetown. They arrested the four remaining activists living inside. Since April 10th, anti-war activists with groups Code Pink and Popular Resistance have been living in the embassy at the invitation of the embattled government of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela. They say they're trying to keep diplomats for the country's opposition government from moving into the building. At about 9:30 Thursday morning, Kevin Zeese, a member of Popular Resistance, and one of the activists still in the building, posted on Facebook that police had broken into the building and said they would arrest the people left inside. Katja Stitt is program director for WBAI's sister station, WPFW, in Washington, D.C.
You'll probably hear in the background chanting from the opposition, needless to say. They are delighted about what has happened here. I understand that some have been arrested and others they are still processing in the back of the embassy, I'm not sure, but this is what we see happen. You can hear the cheers and the chants and the jeers, really, from the opposition. You also see heavy, heavy, heavy police presence. All around the embassy has been shut down by police officers. You also see the tragedy of policemen actually high-fiving what is happening here, which really, in our minds, is a breach of what the police are supposed to be doing, which is protecting all individuals. And clearly, their interests lie with the opposition right now and protecting the opposition. So I am here with Lily and, of course, Ariel from Code Pink, as well as Naina from BYP 100, Black Youth Project 100. And I understand we're also joined by WBAI, our sister station in New York, so we want to thank them for tuning in. This is an important moment. I'm going to turn the phone over right now to Ariel, who, of course, held so courageously, as did Lily, this embassy for such a long time, and they are here to tell the story and also what it means, what today means, not just in D.C., but in Venezuela. And then we're going to talk to Naina about what this intersectionality means, because it is not just Venezuela under attack. It is really freedom and justice and the right for a country to determine its own trajectory. So, Ariel, good morning, and thank you for joining us.
Hi, I'm Ariel Gold. I'm the National Co-Director for Code Pink. And Code Pink, as well as Popular Resistance and Answer Coalition and many activists, have for 37 days now until today been protecting the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C. from takeover by an opposition government, opposition administration that has no legitimacy, that is not a government, that is part of a coup attempt, a failed, multiple times failed coup attempt by the Trump administration, by war hawk John Bolton, and war criminal Elliot Abrams. And so for 37 days, Code Pink and others have been living inside the embassy with under permission from the legitimate Venezuelan government to protect it from being taken over. And I'm going to turn it over to my colleague to talk a little bit about what the last 37 days have been like.
So my name is Lily. I also work for Code Pink, and I'm their Iran coordinator. And in the last 37 days, so I was inside the embassy at one point, and it's honestly are invading this embassy, and I'm sad to see this and afraid to see what will happen in Venezuela.
I wanted to ask you both, could you tell us, outline for us exactly what happened with the raid this morning?
Well, around 9 a.m., we got a message from Kevin Zeese, one of the four embassy protectors that was still in the building, and there was a tweet from Adrian Pine, another of those embassy protectors, that the building was being invaded, which is a violation of the Vienna Convention.
And really stormed. I just want to make
stormed.
That
clear. Absolutely.
It was not stormed. A peaceful coming.
No, we hear they broke down the door and stormed the building. And from then, we were unable to maintain contact with our colleagues and dear friends inside and became worried, of course, about their safety because the Secret Service has shown that they do not uphold basic human rights. They have allowed vile physical assaults. harassment, sexual assault to take place outside the building and refuse to stop that, refuse to arrest for those assaults. So, you know, we've been out here since then, you know, deeply concerned about what's happening. And just recently, we finally saw two police cars leave with our friends and colleagues inside. And they said to us, this is illegal, because it sure is illegal. And this puts the U.S. Embassy in Caracas at risk. This puts the Venezuelan people at risk of civil war. And we know that when civil wars happen, when U.S. military intervention happens, we know that it's the poor, that it's people of color, that it's, you know, it's children who are the most vulnerable and who get hit the worst by the impact, not just in the moment, not just those violent actions in the moment, but for decades and centuries to come, as entire regions are destabilized, as violence becomes more of a part of daily life, as further poverty takes over. And so shame on the Trump administration for doing this today. Shame on Elliot Abrams and John Bolton and the State Department and Mike Pompeo. This is a sad day for democracy, a sad day for international law, a sad day for the entire world.
Katja Stitt is program director for WBAI's sister station, WPFW, in Washington, D.C. She was on hand as police arrested four members of the Embassy Protection Collective who were occupying the Venezuela embassy in Georgetown. Meanwhile, Venezuelan Deputy Foreign Minister Carlos Ron urged the Trump administration not to hand over the country's embassy in D.C. to leaders of an attempted coup after U.S. law enforcement forcibly removed the peace activists. And Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez and Canadian Foreign Minister Chrystia Freeland have met in Havana to discuss the crisis in Venezuela. Rodriguez confirmed the Thursday meeting on his Twitter account, then wrote that Cuba ratifies its willingness to contribute to initiatives that promote respectful dialogue with the government of the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. Cuba's foreign minister said talks on Venezuela should be based on the sovereign equality of states, international law, and the will of Latin America to be a zone of peace. Freeland had announced her trip in Havana the day before. Her trip came as diplomatic efforts aimed at resolving Venezuela's crisis accelerated, with its government in opposition sending envoys to talk in Norway. The Norwegian attempt to mediate comes amid tensions that exploded in street violence when the opposition called in vain for a military uprising. Concurrently, the United Nations says Secretary General Antonio Guterres is very much supportive of talks in Norway between Venezuela's government and opposition. A UN spokesperson says he didn't want to predict what can happen, and what we know is a complicated situation. But what is clear is that the Secretary General's good offices, the United Nations' good offices, remain very much available. And in other potential war news, U.S. President Donald Trump said on Thursday he hoped the United States was not heading to war with Iran as he met with Switzerland President Uli Maurer, whose nation has served as a diplomatic conduit between the two countries. Asked by reporters if Washington was going to war with Tehran, Trump responded, "Hope not," as he greeted Maurer at the White House. Reports of mysterious explosions on oil tankers and the redeployment of American military might to the region has transfixed the world, as rapidly escalating tensions between the two old enemies mirror similar escalations before the 2002 invasion of Iraq. Major Danny Scherzin is a U.S. Army strategist and former history instructor at West Point. He served tours with reconnaissance units in Iraq and Afghanistan. He says hardline neoconservatives John Bolton and Defense Secretary Mike Pompeo are driving policy that could have tragic results.
The idea that there's all these new threats from Iran is bunk. And if it's not bunk, they ought to show them to the American people, or at least show them to Congress. Because I watched Bob Melendez from New Jersey, who is a highly ranked member on the Foreign Affairs Committee, say that he didn't know. He was unaware of the evidence they were using to bring America onto a war footing and 120,000 troops. So I don't think it's quite as bad as the lead up to Iraq. I hope it's not as bad. But I'm still very, very concerned that Trump is being pulled in a direction towards war.
There's a plan that he can't stop in front of him. Is that a possibility?
In many instances, these sorts of missions, they take on a fear-mongering. They take on an inertia of their own. And it almost becomes fait accompli. It's just going to happen, you know, and no one knows how to shut it off. And because we have a Congress that has obviated itself of its constitutional duty to declare war, There is no check on the President of the United States. There is no check whether he wants to press a button and annihilate the world or whether he wants to send 120,000 troops potentially to their death. There is no check left on the American president. Do you know what that makes the American president? It makes him an emperor.
120,000 troops in a country of 60 million, as big as Iran with a nationalist aware population, would that be a cakewalk?
Absolutely not. We were told that Iraq, which is about a third of the size of Iran and has a considerably smaller population, almost half the population at the best, we were told that was going to be a cakewalk. And it consumed 150 and 180,000 American occupiers for years. They fought me to a stalemate in 2006. They fought us to a stalemate in 2008. We didn't get out of there until 2011. Of course, we had to come back. The reality is that nation building and regime change and the basic duty of occupying an unwilling people, 120,000 troops will not scratch the surface.
What is the possibility of other countries getting involved?
Our oldest allies across the Atlantic have already made it clear that they think we are nuts. They're not signing on for this. Most of them didn't sign on for Iraq, but even the British who did, they're saying, no way, sir. Does this escalate into a potential, you know, major power conflict with either China or Russia? Maybe. I think the answer is maybe. I want to believe that Putin and Xi Jinping actually have more restraint than Donald Trump. I mean, I need to believe that in order to sleep at night, in order to believe that we're not going to have World War III. But if they don't have more restraint than Mr. Trump, absolutely, this could spiral into a world war. Iran is a lot closer to Russia. It touches former Russian republics. Okay, so it's their neighborhood, not ours. We're thousands of miles from home. They're hundreds of miles from home. A war is going to shut the Straits of Hormuz, through which a vast amount of oil ferries through every day. It's going to shut it down for who knows how long, months, years. So if you're an energy-consuming country like, say, China, you can't afford to have America defeat Iran or getting to a maelstrom in Iran where they can shut down the straits with their service to naval missiles. So yeah, there's a real opportunity of this spiraling out of control.
What has been motivating this desire to get into a fight with Iran for so many years? What's been the threat from them?
The motivation is a military-industrial complex combined with a neoconservative ideology, okay, almost a theology, that believes that America ought to control the key straits in the world and ought to control the key energy resources in the world. That's the motivation, and a lot of people are making money. But you know who's not making money off it? The private that served under me, who I saw die, who I saw kill, who I saw maimed, who makes $28,000 a year, there's no profit motive for him. I remain proud of my service in the Army. I remain proud of the 18 years I spent in uniform. What changed for me was that I fought in an unwinnable war in Afghanistan, that they should have been honest was unwinnable, and I fought in an unnecessary war, an ill-advised, immoral war in Iraq. When I realized that, and when I realized I could no longer look a mother in the eyes and tell her why her son died, when that happens, that's when I decided to dissent. So I still love my country, and I think true patriotism is a sense of skeptical dissent.
Danny Surgeon is a U.S. Army strategist and former history instructor at West Point. He served tours with reconnaissance units in Iraq and Afghanistan. And in more national news, a report released Thursday by the Office of Government Ethics shows that revenue in President Donald Trump's key properties held steady last year despite a turbulent 2 years in office that bruised his brand. Trump's Doral Golf Course and Club in Miami took in the most among his golf properties, generating about $76 million in revenue last year, about $1 million more than in 2017. His Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida took in nearly $23 million, a drop of more than $2 million. Trump's Washington, D.C. hotel near the White House, a magnet for lobbyists and foreign interests, generated nearly $41 million, up less than $1 million from last year. The report also showed Trump's debt increased over the past year by $10 million to at least $315 million. And a New Hampshire school cafeteria worker's kindness may have got her fired. Bonnie Kimball says she was terminated March 28th by her employer, a vendor that supplies food to the Muscoma Valley Regional High School in Canaan. It came a day after she gave a student lunch, even though he couldn't pay for it. Kimball says that when the student's account showed no funds, she quietly told him, "Tell your mom you need money," and provided a lunch. A spokeswoman for the company company would only say an employee would not be let go because she provided lunch to a student. The incident comes as schools across the country are struggling to deal with how to address students who can't pay for their lunch. A 2011 survey found that a majority of districts had unpaid lunch charges and that most dealt with it by offering students alternative meals. Reportedly, several cafeteria workers quit their jobs in solidarity with Kimball after she was dismissed. And casino giant MGM Resorts is telling federal regulators it thinks it might pay up to $800 million to settle liability lawsuits stemming from the October 2017 mass shooting that became the deadliest in modern U.S. history. The company also tells the Securities and Exchange Commission it insured for $751 million of that amount. About 4,200 claimants say they were harmed when the shooter rained gunfire from a Mandalay Bay Resort suite into an open-air concert, killing 58 people and injuring more than 800. And in New York City, Mayor Bill de Blasio made it official today. He threw his hat in the race for president to replace Donald Trump. He joins about two dozen candidates for the Democratic Party nod to face Trump next year. In mounting a bid, the mayor is essentially ignoring the voters who overwhelmingly elected him to City Hall twice. An April 3rd Quinnipiac poll found 70% of New York City voters opposed the idea of him running for the White House. De Blasio becomes the first sitting mayor of New York City to run for president since John Lindsay's brief run in 1972. De Blasio follows other tri-state Democrats running for president, including New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand and New Jersey Senator Cory Booker. And in New Jersey, State Senate President Steve Sweeney said Tuesday he was giving up on the effort to legalize recreational marijuana and instead would put the issue up for voters to decide in 2020. Sweeney said he would also move forward with bills to expand the state's medical cannabis program and expunge existing marijuana convictions. Roseanne Scotti is New Jersey Executive Director of the Drug Policy Alliance. She says supporters of the bill just couldn't put together enough votes.
There weren't enough votes in the New Jersey Senate to pass the bill. They tried to do this about a week ago and ended up pulling the bill because they came up a few votes short, and then the decision was made, how do we move forward? And what the Senate president announced yesterday was that he was going to move forward with an expansion of the medical marijuana program, and he says hold off on doing adult use legalization until 2020 as a ballot initiative.
What were the laws that were being considered?
An adult use bill that would have allowed people 21 and over to access marijuana legally through state regulated dispensaries. And obviously it was a much more complex piece of legislation than that, but that was the gist of the bill. And the bill also contained provisions for expungement of previous records, racial equity pieces to support a diverse industry, and all of that is on hold for the time being.
What was the main reason why this bill failed, in your opinion?
Basically, the Senate president said he just didn't have enough votes. I would just want to point out that even though he has said this will wait till 2020 and do it as a ballot initiative, the legislation could be voted on at any time if we can change a few more minds. So I don't think that's the only route for this. That is what they've decided for the moment, but we're still working on this and are going to continue to advocate for it. And I think that different legislators had different issues. They're the same sort of issues that have come up in other states, particularly making sure that we have a system that can keep marijuana away from young people, which the bill did, but there just wasn't yet that level of comfort for enough senators to vote for it.
An aspect of it, as far as communities that had been targeted by drug laws in the past, would have an opportunity to set up businesses to make up for that?
Absolutely. Our main focus at Drug Policy Alliance has been the racial equity components of the bill and making sure that past harms to communities of color are repaired and are addressed, because around the country there's a disparate impact in terms of who's arrested. Here in New Jersey, African Americans are four times as likely to be arrested for marijuana possession as whites, even though both groups use marijuana at the same rate. And so we need to really address that and fix that. And so in addition to the expungement piece, there were pieces that said, you know, someone with a previous conviction could not be barred from the industry because that's happened in other states. And so obviously if you're doing that, the people that you're not letting into this new industry are people who've been targeted unfairly in the past. The bill also set up what it called impact zones, where some priority would be given to licenses based on certain areas having high poverty rates and high unemployment rates and past high levels of marijuana arrests. So this was really the focus of this bill and something that few, if any, other states have done.
An expungement? Was that a problem to pass an expungement part of this law?
It was not difficult to pass expungement for just possession offenses. No one really had a problem with that. But we wanted to go beyond that because, again, so many people get arrests for low-level marijuana distribution. And, you know, we're entering a world where people are going to be making a lot of money distributing marijuana under a new legal system. And so we felt that the majority of those previous offenses for distribution should also be able to be expunged. And that was something that some legislators had a harder time with, for sure.
How many thousands and thousands of young people had their lives changed forever because of a little bit of pot or something like that?
Tragically, we're still doing that. There's more than 30,000 people arrested every year in New Jersey just for possession. And the majority of them are people of color. Some of them are young people. And, you know, as we all know, this is a stigma that sticks with people for the rest of their lives and can affect their ability to get housing and jobs and student loans. We are very, very disappointed that this isn't moving forward now, because every single day, more people are getting arrested and more people are having their lives derailed. So we're going to do everything we can to change the minds we need to change so that we can get this done before 2020, because we really can't wait till 2020.
Roseanne Scotti is New Jersey Executive Director of the Drug Policy Alliance. Governor Murphy's hopes for a legal cannabis industry are a casualty in the ongoing war between New Jersey leaders over a tax incentive program that has benefited businesses linked to South Jersey Democratic power broker George Norcross. Norcross has floated the possibility of backing a primary challenger if and when Murphy seeks re-election in 2021. And Wednesday night, New York State's Department of Environmental Protection said it will not grant a key permit for a controversial gas pipeline to be built in Lower New York Harbor. Environmental groups call this a temporary win in their fight against the Northeast Supply Enhancement Project, otherwise known as the Williams Pipeline. WBAI's Reva Goldberg was at City Hall earlier today, where she recorded a statement by Laura Schindel of Food and Water Watch.
This is a huge victory! It's a temporary one, but we've proven twice now that people power and science can go up against the fossil fuel industry and win. While we've stopped the Williams pipeline for now, our work is far from over. New York State faces a slew of fossil fuel projects, power plants like Danskammer, Cricket Valley, and the Meadowlands right across the Hudson River. Meanwhile, in Albany right now, our legislators are considering climate legislation. We must fight for climate legislation that puts a stop to all fossil fuel projects. We cannot build the renewable future that we need while simultaneously building out fossil fuels. And while New York is stepping up to protect its communities, we have a federal government that will do everything they can to ignore science and expand the fossil fuel industry. So while our federal government works on behalf of corporate profits, we need states to step up and protect us. That is, until we get a federal government that will protect all of its citizens.
Transco, a subsidiary of the Oklahoma gas infrastructure company Williams, proposed the pipeline. It would carry Pennsylvania frack gas from the coast of New Jersey past Staten Island to an existing transfer point a few miles off Rockaway Beach. For over 2 years, the Stop the Williams Pipeline Coalition has organized public hearings, protests, and press conferences to fight the project. The coalition also says the underwater construction would pollute the harbor and harm wildlife and neutralize Governor Andrew Cuomo's promise of a Green New Deal for New York. And finally, today, the U.S. House of Representatives conducted a marathon reading of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's redacted report in the White House Rules Committee room. More than two dozen lawmakers are taking part. New York's Jerry Nadler, chair of the Judiciary Committee, says the reading is important because it's damning. And that's some of the news for Thursday, May 16th, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry and Reva Goldberg. Our engineer is James Irsay. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for joining us. Take her.